Good morning. I'm Larry. I'm going to talk to you about the original pain. Today's story has two threads. The first is a story of one man who made an extraordinary difference. Not by great feats of strength nor heroism. He wrote in plain English and changed the world and changed history. Whatever your cause, war, immigrants, climate, women's rights, foreign affairs, healthcare, civic engagement, listen to how he did it. Scribbling his case longhand, setting type, distributing pamphlets and magazines. One voice can make all the difference. One person can bend history, light the path, inspire, motivate. And one voice from that time we celebrate this week has lessons still useful today. The other thread is about the time we celebrate this week, what it felt like to be there in the 1770s inside a war. To that end, note the passage of time between today's message, between the dates I'll be mentioning, the pace and the seasons. Our story begins in England with Thomas Paine in 1737, born to a staymaker in a small town east of Cambridge. Went to sea as a privateer while a teen. Returned. Lost his young wife in early labor. Failed as a merchant. Divorced by his second wife. As a tariff collector in late 1773, he pressed the, quote, case of the excise officers to members of Parliament, arguing that tax collectors ought to be paid a living wage. That kind of makes sense. After pressing his case for months, after a dozen years with His Majesty's Excise Office at age 36, he was fired. Unemployed in London, he met Ben Franklin, who suggested he try his luck in Philadelphia and gave him letters of introduction. When he landed in late November 74, he was so sick, Ben Franklin's physician had to have him carried off the ship. Five sailors had died of typhoid fever on that trip. Paine took 6 weeks to recover and then embarked on a new career as a writer and editor with a new Pennsylvania magazine in February of 1775. Now, when he arrived, Thomas Paine arrived then, it was a decade after the British had won the French and Indian Wars, which actually expanded the American colonies by about a factor of two. It was 4 years after the 1770 Boston Massacre. It was a year after the Boston Tea Party. And it was after the British Parliament had enacted three so-called intolerable acts. 2 months before he arrived, Governor Gage had dissolved the Massachusetts Provincial Assembly under his newly enhanced royal authority. That entire assembly adjourned to Concord and declared themselves the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, with John Hancock as its president. It became the de facto government of Massachusetts throughout the war and beyond. The point is that the colonies were already openly defying the authority of the British government. Except for the presence of the British Army, however, life was pretty good in the American colonies in 75. 240 years ago. There was lots of room. From Maine to Georgia to Tennessee, the total population, a bit over 2.5 million, was about three quarters the population of San Diego County today. Life was rural. Very few lived in towns. Philadelphia, where Thomas Paine landed, was the largest city with, at 40,000 people, so it was a little smaller than El Centro out in Imperial County. New York City, at 25,000, was the size of Ramona. Boston, at 16,000, was a little bit larger than Solana Beach. The fourth largest, Charleston, South Carolina, was even smaller than that. Fewer than 1 in 20 in New England lived in a town. In the South, 1 in 40 lived in towns. New Englanders from Connecticut to Maine were English. Pennsylvanians and New Yorkers were diverse, Dutch, German, Scotch, Swedes, Finns, Irish, as well as English. Half the colonial population, about 1.25 million, lived in the South. 500,000 of those, Southerners, were slaves. It's about 20% of the total population. The colonies were quiet. There weren't any engines or motors. You didn't hear interstate. All you heard were sounds of nature and animals, horses, chickens. Nonetheless, the economy was booming. The standards of living for common people was actually the highest in the world, better than England. The middle class was large and relatively comfortable. No one was extremely wealthy. Even the bottom 20% earned more than the bottom 20% in England. That included slaves. Nearly everyone relied on their own gardens and animals for food, transport, money. No plumbing, no cell phone, cable, internet. News was learned at trading posts and taverns and from weekly newspapers and monthly magazines, sometimes read out loud in taverns. Thomas Paine, writer and editor, was listening, reading, scribbling, printing. April 19th, 1775, made news. Thousands of British troops were stationed in and around Boston. The locals disliked the royal governor a lot and British rules. Tensions were high. In the wee hours of April 19th, like midnight, 700 troops quietly left Boston for Concord on foot to seize weapons and powder. Word preceded them during the night. At Lexington, they faced 77 local minutemen at the beginnings of dawn. A shot was fired. A melee followed. 8 locals were killed. By the time they reached Concord, the British were facing hundreds of armed militia. During the long march back to Boston, 73 British troops and 50 minutemen were killed. Militia forces gathered rapidly into thousands, surrounding and isolating the British forces. The siege of Boston had begun. News of the bloodshed and the siege of Boston spread rapidly, shifting opinions from supporting reconciliation with King George to supporting a complete break with Great Britain. Among those so affected was our new immigrant friend, Thomas Paine. Also inspired by the news were militia leaders from Vermont and Connecticut who rallied support, marched to upstate New York, and seized Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain from the British on May 10th. On that same day, May 10th, 1775, in Philadelphia, the Continental Congress convened. A month later, in June, George Washington was appointed commander-in-chief of a newly defined Continental Army and promptly left for Boston to forge an army out of these ad hoc militia. He faced daunting odds. The militia were diverse volunteers, untrained, undisciplined, no experience against professional military. The British Army was the best in the world. Reinforcements were expected, including the British Navy. As winter closed in November of 75, Washington dispatched a few troops back to Fort Ticonderoga, about 300 miles away, to retrieve British cannons abandoned there. Meanwhile, in January 1776, 9 months after the shooting started, Thomas Paine published a 49-page pamphlet titled Common Sense. A 100,000 copies sold within 3 months. That's roughly equal to the combined population of the 5 largest cities. This was a bestseller. Common Sense made the case for American independence convincingly, making points very briefly, such as monarchy is obsolete, expensive, capricious, and generally a bad idea. Hereditary succession is also. Kings drag nations into war. Britain's enemies are not our enemies, and the king's interests are not our interests. Commerce with all nations is our wish, and is a natural defense. Reconciliation between America and Great Britain is no longer possible. The appeal to arms was the choice of the king, and the continent has accepted the challenge. The only way forward for us is independence. This continent is too vast to be governed by a small, distant island nation. A government of our own is our natural right. A Continental Congress is needed. The law is and will be our only king. We can afford our own nation, our own navy. American colonies have been building the world's best ship for over a century. The colonies have plenty of tar, timber, hemp for cordage and ironworks. A declaration for independence is needed so that other nations may lawfully assist us as a nation and not as rebels. In short, Paine's pamphlets offered a vision of a bright future for an independent America and bleak prospects for a future under British rule. Paine's pamphlet inspired enthusiastic support for independence. Some, including John Adams, found the pamphlet dangerously democratic. Real democracy, where everyone can vote for their representatives and leaders, was scary to the comfortable. Still is. Meanwhile, troops were dragging 60 tons of cannons 300 miles from Fort Ticonderoga back to Boston in the winter. The cannons actually arrived. When they were installed on heights overlooking Boston and Boston Harbor, Britain's General Howe in Boston got the point. Loaded 10,000 troops on 120 ships and left Boston for Nova Scotia on March 17, 1776. Now, we would think of that as the end of winter. Having lived in Boston, that's not the end of winter. That lifted spirits in the colonies. With that withdrawal, British troops controlled none of the colonies, actually, by force. But it was clear to all that they would be back in force. Washington moved his 19,000-man Continental Army south and fortified New York. And at the end of June, 130 ships landed and unloaded 20,000 troops on Staten Island. A few days later, down in Philadelphia, the Continental Congress issued the Declaration of Independence, echoing sentiments found in Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Since it's a July 4th weekend, I'm going to read three paragraphs from that declaration. When in the course of human rights it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature entitle them, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind requires they should declare the causes which impel them to separate. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute a new government, laying its foundations on principles in organizing its powers in such form as to them seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence dictates that governments long established should not be changed for light reasons. Mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they're accustomed. But when a long train of abuses evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it's their right and duty to throw off such government and provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity to alter the systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is the history of repeated injuries and having in direct object the establishment of absolute tyranny over the states. Then they list 21 complaints. And they close with this, that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they're absolved from their allegiance to the British Crown, that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is totally dissolved, And that is, free and independent states, they have full power to levy wars, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do other acts which independent states may do. And for the support of this declaration, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Now that lifted the spirits of the colonies. While in August and September, the Brits took New York City. By December, Washington's army had been driven out of New York, across New Jersey, into Pennsylvania. With that, spirits sank. Washington's army shrank. On December 23rd, while Washington's remaining 5,000-man army hunkered down in Pennsylvania along the Delaware River, Thomas Paine published The American Crisis, which began, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an object as freedom should not be highly rated. Britain, with an army to enforce her tyranny, has declared that she has the right not only to tax, but to bind us in all cases whatsoever. And if being bound in that manner is not slavery, then there's no such thing as slavery on earth." Washington, General Washington, was so inspired by this pamphlet that he ordered it read aloud to all his troops on Christmas Day. And on Christmas night in 1776, Washington quietly marched his troops and guns north, crossed the icy Delaware River on barges, marched 20 miles south in sleet and snow, routed 1,500 Hessian and British troops from Trenton, New Jersey, taking 900 prisoners, and returned to camp by nightfall. Then one imagined they slept. A week later, 6,000 British troops attacked and were rebuffed. Overnight then, in January, Washington marched his troops around the Brits and all the way to Princeton and captured a smaller force. Stung twice, the British army withdrew from New Jersey and both sides retired to winter quarters. With that, having driven the generals out of New Jersey, spirits were lifted throughout the colonies. But Washington knew what would come next. In late August 1777, 18,000 British troops disembarked at the north end of the Chesapeake Bay, 50 miles from Philadelphia. Washington's army of 20,000 at that time was in the way. Early on September 11th, 1777, the British attacked, flanking Washington. By nightfall, hundreds were dead on both sides. The Continental Army under Washington withdrew. Spirits sank. Congress relocated inland. Philadelphia fell to the Brits. On September 12th, the day after the big battle, Thomas Paine's fourth American crisis rallied support for the cause and lifted spirits, and closed with a short address directly to British General Howe. "You, sir, are only lingering out the period that shall bring with it your defeat. You have scarce begun the war. The further you enter, the faster will your troubles thicken. What you now enjoy is only a respite from ruin, an invitation to destruction, something that will lead on to our deliverance at your expense. We know the cause we are engaged in, and though a passionate fondness for it may make us grieve at every injury, when the moment passes, the determination to duty returns. We are not moved by the gloomy smile of a worthless king, but by the ardent glow of generous patriotism. We fight not to enslave, but to set a country free and to make room upon the earth for honest men to live. In such a cause, we are sure we are right, and we leave you the despairing reflection of being the tool of a miserable tyrant. Of course, that was distributed. That lifted spirits, even while General Howe occupied Philadelphia, the largest city. But then, 3 weeks later, in upstate New York, British General Burgoyne surrendered his army at Saratoga. That lifted spirits. 4 months after that, February 6, 1778, France signed a treaty of alliance with the United States. That was a big boost. Thomas Paine continued with 9 more American crisis papers before the war was resolved. The painful battles continued for 4 more years until before Parliament voted against further war with America on February 27th of 1782. A year and a half later, a peace treaty was finally signed on September 3rd, 1783. 8 years after the shots were first fired in Lexington. Now, a year after that, Thomas Paine returned to London, publishing The Rights of Man in 1791, an anti-monarchy, anti-establishment book. Sued for libel in London, he went to France in the middle of a revolution, where he was elected to the French National Convention. He couldn't even speak French. He helped write a French constitution. And somehow he was imprisoned in December of 1793 by the new guy, Robespierre. While in prison, he wrote The Age of Reason in 1794 while waiting for the guillotine. He was spared after a year. Robespierre fell. He was re-elected. He met Napoleon, who was a huge fan of Thomas Paine, advised Napoleon on how to invade Great Britain. He returned to the U.S. in 1803, where he wasn't really as popular as he used to be. He wrote The Rights of Man, which The Age of Reason also, which was very much an anti-religion book. He ripped apart the Bible. He was also recognized later as the first American to propose an old age pension and a basic income. And he's recognized by the Social Security Administration as being the first to propose that. So as Thomas Paine could have said, to right wrongs, right.